I'd like now to welcome to the program Janet Heimlich. She's an award-winning journalist, she's a former NPR reporter, and she's the author of the new book, Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment. She will be speaking and signing books tonight at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Santa Fe at 7 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So let's just start with the title. What do you mean by religious child maltreatment?
Well, child abuse and neglect, which is what maltreatment is, it includes both types of behavior. There are so many different factors that can lead to abuse and lead to neglect, mental illness, poverty, etc. What I found from my research is that religious belief is one of those factors, and I think people don't really see that as being perhaps a harmful influence, but the fact is that kids are raised with extremist faith from birth or introduced to it later in life, and because everyone around them is so tied up with a certain belief system, people don't really think that it can be harmful, but in fact it can, and can actually in some cases be fatal.
Now, we're not talking about all religious beliefs. We're talking about very specific things that you outline in the book, but one kind of overarching theme is authoritarianism and an excessive focus on obedience.
Right. I make it really clear in the book that a religious upbringing can be a great experience for a kid. And I've interviewed a number of people that love their religious upbringings. What I try to do is differentiate between healthy faith for kids and unhealthy faith. And what I found after studying so many cases, talking to so many survivors and perpetrators, reading dozens of studies and criminal cases, is that there's a theme that runs through a lot of these cases, which is the authoritarian nature of the environment of the child. It doesn't really matter whether it's a Christian-based system, Jewish-based system, Muslim, or something else. It really has to do with the way that the culture is structured and the kind of beliefs that go on in the child's culture. And so if you do have an authoritarian culture, and by culture I mean a place of worship, a community, a household, if it's authoritarian, and I give three what I call perfect storm characteristics of what an authoritarian culture is, then kids, I think, are more at risk for religious child maltreatment.
What are those three perfect storm characteristics?
The first is there is a strict social hierarchy. So you're going to have religious leaders having way more power than most people in the culture. Almost always men have a lot more power than women. Children have essentially next to no rights. The second is that the members are quite fearful. And this could be from an ideology such as apostates going to hell and, you know, suffering greatly in the afterlife if they don't abide by certain rules. Or it can be more from customs. So if people are made to feel that they're unworthy, say if their kids don't get married early in life and if people don't have a lot of children and, again, abide by certain rules, they can be shunned or excommunicated, either formally or informally. The third is that the culture is socially separatist, which basically means that they conduct themselves according to their own rules, and they're quite separate from general society.
And they think their way is better than everybody else's way.
Right. Narcissism often goes along with these cultures, where they think their one belief system is the only true belief system, and that everyone else is either misguided or evil or, you know, destined to be eternally damned.
Now, how is the child abuse that you report on specifically a product of religion as opposed to regular child abuse that happens to be perpetrated by people who go to church?
Yeah, well, it takes different forms, but I found that, you know, essentially you're dealing with religious extremism. For whatever psychological reasons might be going on, there are adults who are so taken by their own faith that it really takes priority over everything, including the child's individual needs. So an example that's on the egregious side would be the faith healing related medical neglect cases, where you'll have a child who may not have been taken to the doctor maybe their whole life because doctors are shunned in that culture, and they think that that faith healing is superior to medical care. So you'll have kids that might get sick, perhaps from something normally very treatable. It could be an infection, but they're not getting antibiotics. It could be diabetes, but they're not getting insulin. Cancer, and they're not, you know, they're allowing tumors to just grow to huge sizes.
Oh, God, there were some harrowing stories in your book. I mean, this little child, I think a toddler with a tumor the size of her head growing out of her eye, and the parents didn't take her to the doctor.
Right, and my recollection of that was that that child actually lived, but certainly there have been many cases where kids did not survive what they were suffering with. And I think what's particularly horrific about the medical neglect cases is the suffering that the kids go through. You know, we don't see kids today dying from diabetes. We don't quite know what does a child go through, or anyone go through, if they're literally going to die from diabetes. It is it involves a great deal of suffering that can go on for weeks, where the body is just breaking down. And there have been a number of high-profile cases, including one in Wisconsin, where an 11-year-old girl named Kara Newman, who hadn't been taken to the doctor since she was three, her diabetes was never diagnosed. And her parents just believe that, you know, if they anoint her with oil and they pray over her, that these symptoms she was having would go away. And, of course, that didn't happen.
And in fact, when she was dead, they were still praying and were thinking that she was going to come back to life.
Right. I sometimes think that the belief that people can be resurrected from the dead actually contributes to that form of maltreatment. I have read about interviews from various people who were continuing to deny their kids medical care because they thought in the back of their mind, well, we'll see them again in the afterlife. This isn't really the end.
Well, there's this whole thing that goes into faith healing, or that syndrome of faith healing where children are not treated for curable diseases and so on, where they say, well, it's God's will.
Right. The belief that everything is God's will contributes to many different problems, including medical neglect, as you're talking about. In some of the more isolated sects, like the Amish or the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they have unusually high rates of genetic disorders, where the kids are born with severe physical defects and mental retardation.
It's what we call inbreeding.
Right. It's from them, again, that social separatist aspect of it, where they're only marrying and having children with people that are related to each other.
Right.
So if you think that, well, everything is God's will, but there are a lot of kids that happen to be born, you know, with some kind of defect. They're not right. They're slow. You know, some people may call them slow. They're not getting tested. They could prevent some of those cases by just having the man and woman be tested, but they refuse to do that because they believe it's God's will. And that was, I found to be particularly true in the Amish. I did interview a woman who was Amish, and she had five children. Three of them each had a particular disease that's been associated with the Amish. They have 80% or something like that of all the cases in the world, just in Amish communities.
And there's this whole Center for the Study of Amish Genetic Diseases.
Yeah, located in Ohio, where a lot of Amish live.
Yeah.
Fortunately, this woman did leave the sect, and she discovered that clinic that you're talking about. And so she was one of the case studies there, where she learned that her kids did have this disease and what caused it. And she said that just coming across that knowledge was so helpful to her that she actually had some understanding of what was going on. But she says couples continue to refuse to get tested for it.
We're talking to Janet Heimlich about her book, Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment. Now, the kinds of things you're talking about, medical neglect, medical abuse, not taking kids to the doctor, that would be punishable. I mean, a felony or a crime. But in some of these communities, or in some states, I guess, there's a religious exemption?
In most states, actually. This was something that was begun by high-ranking members of the Christian Science Church, who also were high-ranking people in the Nixon administration. And in the 70s, through a policy change they worked out with the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, they got the department to tie federal funding to passing these religious exemptions. As a result, in most states, a handful or so have repealed these exemptions, but unfortunately, a majority of states still have them on the books, where parents who allow their children to die from medical neglect, as long as it was all done for religious reasons, if they were believers of faith healing as part of a major religious institution, which is how the Christian Science Church got the language to be written, the state cannot call it neglect. And so in many cases, they essentially get prosecutorial immunity. Some prosecutors have been trying to get around that by charging them with child abuse, which doesn't fall under the, you know, trying to technically work around it. But unfortunately, the states that have repealed it tend to wait until there is a tragedy or a series of tragedies. And oftentimes they really only pass when the Christian Science Church does not lobby to against making that change.
Well, and another irony is that the whole thing was repealed on the federal level, and yet these states still have the laws.
Well, yeah, if the states have the laws, then they go by that. And Oregon is the most recent state to overturn its religious exemption. But this was after who knows how many decades of a particular church there called the Followers of Christ. I mean, literally untold babies, children, their mothers and, you know, fathers, I mean, you know, adults as well. But because that particular church does not believe in medical care, you know, they just have a graveyard of unmarked graves because so many babies were born, you know, stillborn and what have you. It's only been now this last summer that Oregon finally repealed. And again, it was only after I think the legislature really couldn't take it anymore of all these kids dying. We've had four cases, serious cases, three were deaths that took place over the last 4 years that were high profile criminal cases.
So was one thing I was thinking while reading your book is there are a lot of ultra-conservative religious people who believe in a right to life. What's going on? I mean, these children, once they're born, don't have a right to life?
Right. I think there is a real hypocrisy there. And, you know, while certainly people have the right to protest abortion and believe that it's wrong or immoral, but to overlook the fact that children, once they're born, have certain rights, which is a right to good quality medical care, a right to feel safe and to be safe. Lately in the news, we've heard a lot about a particular Tennessee-based conservative minister named Michael Pearl, who has written a lot of books, and he preaches a lot about the need to use corporal punishment on children. And like many conservative Protestant religious leaders and so-called parenting experts, they believe that because the Bible talks about the corporal punishment of children, therefore it's necessary that parents use corporal punishment as long as the child is acting in what they consider to be a rebellious way. There is a passage in the Bible that says that if you beat a child, you're going to save him from going to hell. These people take this literally.
That whole spare the rod as the phrase goes, spare the rod, spoil the child, which, as I learned from your book, isn't actually in the Bible, but they sort of interpret it as if it were.
Right. I think many people don't realize that that phrase does not exist in the Bible. It was part of a poem written, you know, hundreds of years later, had nothing to do with the corporal punishment of children.
Right.
But the idea of spare the rod is something that many conservative believers latch onto. And in fact, because the word the rod is talked about in the Bible, you even have companies that sell what they call the rod online for the specific purpose of hitting children.
They sell online. Ladies and gentlemen, you can buy spanking devices online.
Right.
Rods.
And you go to these online sites, and they're filled with biblical passages. So what you have when you have a lot of these...
And you can buy a paddle with biblical passages inscribed on it and hit your kids with it.
Sure, actually, churches have designed these themselves, you know, where their parents are walking around with these devices. My big concern is that you asked about, you know, how does religion actually kind of work its way in here? And I talked about fanatical beliefs. Yeah, there are certain people that are just going to latch on to some ideology in a fanatical way. But I think all that is helped along when you have people who are perceived as religious leaders telling people, for example, in the case of Michael Pearl, God spanks his own children. He actually says that. And
what does that mean?
Well, it's just a line. It's an interpretation he has of the Bible, because there is a passage that says something about God being a disciplinarian. But when you have these people that are perceived to be religious authorities saying, "You have to do this," or if you don't, you're really actually harming your child, because you're perhaps getting in the way of saving them from eternal damnation. So that's a really strong and fear-based message that I think a lot of parents, you know, hear and feel like, you know, they're obligated to then use corporal punishment. And sometimes that gets out of hand and becomes physically abusive.
And there are children who die from it.
Yeah, in fact, three children now have died at the hands of followers of Michael Pearl. In all three cases, the parents had his book in their house. I should say the third case has not yet gone to trial. But in that case, the prosecutor said as well that Michael Pearl's book was there. And he talks about, on his website, using quarter-inch-wide plumbing pipe to hit children with. And in all three cases, witnesses said that the parents used this particular plumbing pipe to beat their kids. And they used a lot of other techniques, too, that he promotes. He says that parents are not listening to his instructions well enough, and that if they really did abide by things that he says in the book, like don't spank in anger, these atrocities wouldn't happen. But I think he's failing to take into account that some parents are just really struggling to raise their child in a compassionate way, that they are feeling that they have to control their kids. You mentioned obedience of children. And there are many parents that have what I call an obsession, a child obedience. So I think he's failing to take into account that there are a lot of folks out there that will read what he says and think that it's okay to beat for hours and hours and hours. In the case of the second child that I mentioned who died, they beat the child for 7 or 9 hours, and they took breaks to pray and to reflect. So this wasn't just sort of all out of anger and out of control. It's all done under the guise of religion.
You say somewhere in the book, we're talking to Janet Heimlich about her book, Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment. You say that there are a lot of things that are taught by these authoritarian churches, and I mean the parents demand obedience from their children, and in turn the church demands obedience from their subjects or from their congregation, and a lot of the things that they are demanding go against parents' instincts as parents. I mean, a mother would never do that to her father, to to their children under normal circumstances if they were following their own instincts as parents.
Right. That's the problem with religious authoritarian cultures. It's the effect that those cultures have on the parents. If you read about the way cults operate, parents are a lot of times called middle managers because they're really not given the autonomy to make instinctual decisions having to do with their children's upbringings. So instead, they're listening to, say, what a pastor says. They're listening to what the other people in the community say. And some people gravitate towards that kind of structure. But I did I did interview a number of people who said, you know, if I had not been in that pro-spanking church, I would not have used those kinds of authoritarian methods to raise my kid. I wouldn't have told my child, now that you've been disobedient, you're going to go to hell. Things like that, I think, happen when parents are essentially denied the right to just make the decision for themselves what they feel is best. Now, of course, a lot of parents do have problems that also interfere with good child-rearing decision-making.
Well, maybe they were beaten themselves.
Well, yes, their past, mental illness, you know, inability to handle stress and anger. But you can certainly see many, many examples of abuses in cults, again, which is kind of the extreme of an authoritarian culture, where child abuse is almost the norm, where it happens in a widespread way. And I think we shouldn't forget that, and I tend to stay away from the word cult because I think people have all these kind of weird perceptions of what it means. But say if you were to take the FLDS, the Polygamous Fundamentalist Mormon sect that has been under investigation over the decades for its custom of marrying girls to older men. It goes along with how they interpret Mormon doctrine, which says that men must marry many virgins. It's not just that you have crazy women that are handing their daughters over to say Warren Jeffs, the leader, or to another man in the group, or you have fathers that have. That they want to see their girls be raped by an older man or something like that. These are not crazy individuals. This is the norm throughout that sect. It's been going on for decades. Now, since the last investigation in Texas, the sect has agreed that they will not continue to conduct child bride rituals. But I can't say that they're really being supervised all that well for us to be sure about that. So I just think it's important to, certainly there are people with mental illness that they could very well harm their children regardless of what kind of influence they grew up with or they're listening to. But in most of the criminal cases, the perpetrators of these kinds of crimes were not found to be incompetent. They stood trial. They weren't found to be insane, guilty by reason of insanity. A lot of times the perpetrators are not even remorseful about it. They say, no, I did what I did because I was following God's law.
And that's what everybody else in their group is doing. There's something that I think is important to talk about, which is the theological views like original sin, like the belief in demons, the idea, I'm going to beat the devil out of you. That's actually a literal thing. They're going to beat the demon. The idea that through beating, you are purifying, and that fits into some theological system. For those outside of that way of thinking, it seems nuts. For those inside, they really think that you can beat evil out of somebody, and there are even exorcisms and things like that, which are tremendously harmful to the children, and the parents believe that there's some kind of transaction happening with invisible demons.
Right. Whereas every faith, extremist faith, is going to provide some kind of excuse, if you will, for physical abuse and excessive corporal punishment. The idea that children are sinful, that they're born sinful, and that somehow they need to be brought in line so that their sinfulness is under control and doesn't interfere with their eternal salvation. That is specifically a Christian problem, or as I might say, an extremist Christian problem, because there are many Christians that don't believe in original sin. There are many Christians that don't believe in a literal hell. But when you have, again, what I call extremist Christianity, very ultra-conservative Christianity, then you will find a lot more, and studies have shown this, a lot more corporal punishment that has been shown to be tied to the belief in child sinfulness. And it is ingrained in those cultures. Again, back to that one biblical passage that if you beat a child, you'll save him from going to hell, that they really believe that they are doing what's in the best interest of their child, to use corporal punishment to rid them of sinfulness. And if you look at parenting books that are written by religious conservatives, whether it's James Dobson or, again, Michael Pearl or a number of these folks, they all talk about the breaking of the will. James Dobson actually talks about the bending of the will, but even if they don't use that phrase, they still are talking about the idea that to help a child become heaven worthy, you must break the will, and you do that oftentimes through corporal punishment, because with sin comes willfulness, and that is something that they believe God frowns upon.
We've talked about medical abuse and neglect. We've talked about physical beating and that kind of child abuse. But then there's another thing that you talk about in the book, which is emotional abuse. What does that look like in a religious context?
Yeah, when I was researching emotional or psychological maltreatment, I learned that there are six forms of it, generally accepted forms of emotional abuse and neglect. I found that four of them in particular were commonly practiced when it comes to religious influences. One is spurning. So back to child sinfulness. If you tell a child that he or she is sinful, Jesus doesn't love them, God's going to send them to hell, what have you, making them feel unworthy, that is spurning. Another form is terrorizing. So the age-old idea that children will burn in hell would be an example of that, and that's been around forever, it seems. Thirdly, exploiting. I actually think that this is the most common form of religious emotional abuse, where parents or other adults are kind of living their faith through a child. Indoctrination goes along with that, making kids go spread the faith and knock door to door to door to door, you know, to have them help with the agenda of a church, for example. And then
instead of having family time at home, for example.
Yeah, I mean, you might have families that are just exhausted from doing all this work for the church, sitting, you know, in services for hours on end, several times a week, and the kids are there, you know, having to sit through all this stuff. It's clearly not designed according to children's needs. The fourth form of religious emotional maltreatment is isolating. And I actually combine exploiting and isolating together in one chapter, because the two forces really feed on each other and compound the problem. So that would be where not only is a child, say, being fed a particular religious viewpoint and being indoctrinated, but they're also kept separate from other influences. They're not learning about other faiths. They're not allowed to get very close to people that don't believe in the same belief system. So those are the four that I focus on in the book.
On top of all that, there's sexual abuse. And when you have sexual abuse, I mean, we certainly have the examples that everybody's heard of with the Catholic Church and these priests who are protected for years, if not decades, and so on. But what are some other examples of sexual abuse being really part of the institutional religion?
Yeah, I think when it comes to sexual abuse, it's a little trickier to assess the religious influences. As you point out, people are aware of the FLDS, but I think that it's not really very well understood or known that there have been religions, religious groups, sometimes cults, that actually promote adult child sex as part of their doctrine, where some sort of sexual experience that we would all call child sexual abuse is actually a form of piety. So the FLDS would be example of that when they are encouraging many people in the culture to perform marriages that involve girls who are underage. There was a well-known cult called the Children of God that did this in a flagrant way. That group today does not practice, does not have any kind of doctrine that has to do with adult child sex. But those are the minority of cases. The majority of cases that involve both sexual abuse of children and religious beliefs more have to do with neglect. We've now seen cases where, for example, in Kansas City, where you have Bishop Robert Finn, the highest-ranking individual in the Roman Catholic Church in the United States, to be indicted for essentially covering up abuse case or failing to report. That's really what he's been charged with. That is a form of neglect to suspect that there is sexual abuse going on and not tell police, not tell Child Protective Services. This is the most pervasive problem in terms of sexual abuse. You see this in Orthodox Jewish communities where rabbis are telling members, if you suspect child sexual abuse, don't go to police. You may not be really equipped to determine whether or not it's a reasonable case to be suspicious of. Come to your rabbi. Let the rabbi decide whether or not the police should be notified. That is obstruction of justice.
Right.
And so we're seeing a lot of cases in the Orthodox Jewish community. I mean, the Amish, you name it, any kind of religious authoritarian culture, you are going to have huge resistance to reporting child sexual abuse, especially if the perpetrator is a religious authority.
Well, some of the stories you tell are so sad and painful to read because you have these religious authority figures, priests or ministers or whatever their title is, who are grooming their victims, sometimes over a period of months or years, to trust them. And so they do all these nice things with them to gain their trust. And then when the abuse finally begins, and it begins in a very mild way, and then it gets worse and worse, and each time the authority figure is saying, no, this is what God wants, and so on, and really using their authority as a member of the church and the authority of God to get these girls to do heinous things that they don't want to do.
Yeah, and grooming is a part of most child sexual abuse, whether it's religion-related or not. And I certainly don't want to downplay the painful experiences of victims who have been sexually abused where religion didn't come into play. But when someone is considered a religious authority, I mean, just about all sexual abuse has to do with a power imbalance. And perpetrators are often, I mean, look at Penn State. I mean, you know, perpetrators are going to try to make use, to take advantage of their status in order to overpower children and procure their silence. But when you have a religious leader who says God is behind him or her, who is someone who is revered in the community, who could do no wrong, and then even when the child tells somebody this has happened and they get punished for it, I mean,
they get punished by the parents for saying,
yeah, how could you say that about Father so-and-so? How could you say that about our imam? How could you say that about Rabbi so-and-so? That goes on. So it's, again, it's just this culture of denial and ignorance and this, what I think is a harmful belief that religious leaders are somehow superhuman. That you know, we're not just going to look up to them for their wisdom, and their respect of our faith and that kind of thing. We're actually going to worship them or revere them. And I think when that happens, when we put people on a religious pedestal like that, we're asking for trouble.
We're talking to Janet Heimlich about her book, Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment. And we're joined by Jennifer Chenoweth. She was interviewed for this book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. I'm a fan of your show.
Oh, thank you. So you were interviewed for this book about religious child maltreatment. Tell us your story.
Well, in the book, we use my maiden name, Gordon, Jennifer Gordon, because my family is still in the fundamentalist ministry, and they use the name Gordon, and I thought that was a little bit more appropriate, being that most of my experience with this happened as a child through my family, not in my current life. I was the youngest of three children, and my parents grew up in the Christian Science Church, and they met at Christian Science Church in Fort Worth. So my father's mother was a very devout Christian scientist. She was a very studious, very hardworking, very independent, smart woman. And that was the religion for her because it gave her access to information and research. And interestingly, at the time of Christian Science, when it was most popular, was also at the rise of the Western male medical establishment. And for a lot of women, this was their refuge for not having to submit to a male medical doctrine that they felt very unempowered.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It is really fascinating. So in one way, I experienced this huge amount of medical neglect, confusion, abuse, stifling, spurning, all these other kinds of things in the Christian Science Church. On the other hand, I was surrounded by smart women who read, and I was very encouraged to be a smart woman who read. I was reading at many grade levels above my age as a child. And that gave me access to a lot of information, which is probably the beginning of what saved me, speaking of salvation. Yeah. But so my dad did some poor business practices and got prosecuted for that and was in the news about the time I was 10, 11, 12. And he got kicked out of the Christian Science Church, which brought the wrath of his mother upon him. And he was very upset that his mother was angry at him about being kicked out of the church. He had shamed her. And my mother and her mother got saved and born again as fundamentalists. And my dad spent a couple of years kind of kicking around and being very morally lost, and it was very difficult years in my family. He didn't have work. He didn't have approval of the women in his life. He didn't have resources. And he realized pretty quickly that in order to gain at least the approval of his wife and his mother-in-law, that he should get on board with being a fundamentalist. And he went far with it. So when my dad decided to become non-denominational fundamentalist, which is their beliefs were faith healing, speaking in tongues, there wasn't a specific set of beliefs. They were very loose and kind of evolved. It was kind of an independent church. Those things evolved as trials and tribulations in the church happened. So we still didn't go to the doctor. It was a very emotional religion, and in that religion, all the men had the power. So it was very terrifying for me because I was a preteen and I had seen my older siblings grow up in a very permissive household, and I had had a very I was neglected a lot as a kid, and I spent a lot of time before I was 10 alone. My family wasn't very safe. They were emotionally abusive. They had strange stressful things going on, and the safest place for me was alone. So I spent a lot of time reading. I had hiding places all over the neighborhood, all over the house. I had stashes of books and flashlights. I had places to go, and I spent most of my time alone. And then I expected, when I got to be a teenager, to get to hang out with my friends as my older siblings had done and be, you know, go do things.
And suddenly you were in a fundamentalist
environment. And suddenly the books were burned, mm-hmm. and the telephone line was cut, and the radios and records were burned and declared. All music was demonic, and it was terrifying. And I basically was told that I could only go to school and church and not to come out of my room otherwise. And it was, as a child, I was a smart, curious, energetic, and willful kid, and very independent. Spent a lot of time just doing my own thing. And as a woman, I am a smart, energetic, determined, curious and independent person. And
thank goodness you had those first 10 years.
Yes, I will say about
not that it was perfect.
It wasn't perfect, and I will. But the strange thing about Christian Science is we had no access to vocabulary about our bodies.
Yeah,
nothing. The denial of physical self was absolute. We had no vocabulary for symptoms. So when you talk about taking a kid to the doctor's, like, I didn't even know how to talk. I didn't have a word for body functions.
Right.
Any words. It was really confusing.
So all of this leads me to a couple of questions, which is, first of all, what do we really know about child rearing? So, for example, can you say, Janet, that there is a better and a worse way of child rearing? I mean, there's one thing that comes up in your book is to have neither permissive nor authoritarian, but some kind of authoritative parenting style. Is that a matter of opinion, or is one way really better than another?
Well, I'm not a child development expert, so I'm not going to tell parents how to raise their kids. But I can say that there have been studies done on how people worship and how people adopt faith for themselves. I'm talking adults now. And these studies showed that those who developed an intrinsic type of faith, that is, where they're really just worshiping for their own internal spiritual betterment of themselves to gain a more enriched well-being, they actually test to show a lower proneness to child abuse, to abusing kids.
Interesting.
And those that had more of a, what they call an extrinsic type of religiosity, where they're adopting faith because, oh, they want to be popular or some reason outside of themselves, they test to show that they are more likely to abuse children.
What about people who want to be part of a community and sing and do good in their community and feed the hungry and all that stuff?
Yeah. And
that's kind of extrinsic.
That can be, absolutely. And that can be wonderful for the adults. It can also be wonderful for the kids. The problem comes when adults force their kids or assume that their kids want the same things that they do. So, yeah, I am just having the greatest time, having this revivalist type 4 or 5 hour church service, and I'm speaking in tongues and it's just fantastic, and I'm going to expect my kid to do the same thing. Well,
right.
Really a lot of it is just stepping away from that authoritarian culture and learning about child development. Yes, authoritative child rearing is considered, by any child psychologist today to be the perfect balance between being too authoritarian or too permissive.
So setting limits with compassion.
Right, and there are ways to incorporate faith by doing those things.
So there are many stories in your book, Breaking Their Will, of people who got out of their religious situation, got out of that tightly knit community, either through leaving, through seeing something was wrong with, through moving, whatever, and go through a real healing process. I mean, what does it take to heal from this? And, I mean, are most people who have been subjected to that kind of abuse, are they on a healing path? Or are they just perpetrating it on their own kids? What's going on?
Well, it runs the gamut. But the people that I interviewed, for the most part, were out of the culture. And they were in various parts of the process of healing, all over the map. So you had some people that had been in therapy for decades and still had things they were struggling with. Others saw therapists who, in fact, I just saw a documentary. It was put on by MSNBC on teen mania. This is, in my estimation, a cult, where you have, who knows, tens of thousands of kids all brought into a stadium-type environment, and it's like this soldiering for Jesus kind of thing. They go through boot camps where they go through just atrocious abuse all in the name of Jesus. Anyway, in this documentary, and you can see all the parts of the documentary online because they're on my Facebook page, but there's a couple that has started to work specifically with kids that come out of Teen Mania. The fact that they're working with them very early on when they're still young seems to have really helped in their healing. But a lot of folks that didn't, you know, get therapy very soon, I think, struggled for a much longer period of time.
What is to be done to prevent this kind of child abuse, to bring it into the public eye, and to basically help to create a more healthy society?
Well, I think a good place to start is with parents. And in my book, I offer about 24 questions that parents can ask themselves to determine whether or not they're in a religious authoritarian culture. So things like, does my pastor tell me that God wants me to spank my kids? If I see a problem, a child is having a problem, say, with emotional development, or I think that there's abuse going on or something like that, do I feel comfortable calling 911? Do I feel comfortable calling Child Protective Services? Or are people going to make me feel guilty that I didn't first bring it to my religious leader or to the religious institution? Things like that. Secondly, there are some legislative changes that I think are really important. Requiring clergy in every state to be a mandated reporter if they suspect abuse.
Yeah.
That is not happening now to the degree that it should. Getting rid of religious exemptions that protect parents whose kids die from religious medical neglect.
Right.
That has to happen as well. I also think that there are things that can be done on the secular level where, say, police departments, prosecutors, attorneys general, Child Protective Services could start now. Even, you know, before problems arise, start work communicating with and building a bridge to some of these more separated separatist cultures, and start getting a relationship going. And I think that's really going to help to try to increase reporting, have these folks get a little more educated on what maltreatment actually is. So those are three areas that I address in the book.
And there's one more thing that I was thinking about as I was reading the book, which is teaching kids to say no, and to say no emphatically.
Absolutely. It's one of the interesting things I found in being a parent is kind of enjoying the teaching my children how to listen to their own voice. They don't have a problem saying no, and they respond very well to uncomfortable situations. And I'm always amazed and surprised at how naturally they are comfortable or uncomfortable and respond to the truth that their body's information gives them. Wow, no, I don't want to be around that person. No, you may not touch me right now. I don't want to do that. That doesn't feel safe to me. I didn't sit down and teach them little workshops on how to do that. They know the truth about what feels right and wrong, and when you validate that in a child, they develop their own moral compass. Whereas when you are denied the information that you believe to be true, and you are told in every way possible that you are wrong, you don't develop that. You deny everything.
Janet Heimlich is an award-winning journalist, former NPR reporter, and author of the book Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment. Jennifer Chenoweth was interviewed for the book. They will be at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Santa Fe tonight at 7 o'clock in the evening, and Janet will be speaking and signing books. The book is also available at Collected Works Bookstore. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.